Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz. Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, criminal justice or crisis control, why the NPA's revival plan isn't convincing everyone. Pharma promises, can the industry really jumpstart Africa's vaccine self-reliance? Rooftop revolution or policy pipe dream, the solar solution under the spotlight? And can the public relations industry rebuild trust in a divided South Africa? It's Wednesday, the 16th of July. Former prosecutor, DA MP and vocal justice for reform, Advocate Glynis Breytenbach, has long been critical of political interference in South Africa's prosecutorial system, and she's now reignited the call for a return to an elite independent anti-corruption unit. She dubs it Scorpions 2.0. In a column for the Daily Maverick, she argues that without a fearless, well-resourced prosecuting authority, South Africa will never win the war against high-level graft. But is reviving a disbanded model the answer, or is this just nostalgia as far as she is concerned? I want to test the strength of that argument with her. Advocate Breytenbach, welcome. And what specific failures in the current NPA and Hawke structures justify a reset?
Good Lord, how much time do you have?
Well, let's get your best answer.
So they're failing at, sadly, despite their best efforts, I'll give them the benefit of the doubt, despite their best efforts, they're failing in ordinary prosecutions, just run-of-the-mill everyday things. Things are slipping through the many cracks. Cases are being withdrawn, never placed back on the roll. Cases are being lost that should never be lost. Cases are being declined to prosecute that should never be declined to prosecute. Just ordinary run-of-the-mill stuff. But then they're failing really badly at the big cases. We've yet to see one person involved in state capture held liable. We've yet to see one big player in state capture be successfully prosecuted and go to jail. This is years down the line. We had the Zondo Commission, which was hugely expensive, did great work, provided a vast amount of information that must, of course, and I acknowledge that, be turned into evidence, which takes a bit of time, but it doesn't take the amount of time that has been consumed here. And we're still seeing nothing being done. So we're seeing no progress. So we need to change the ball game. There's no point in just carrying on and on and on and on. We all know that if you keep doing the same thing over and over again, you're going to get the same result.
Do you think it's a capacity and competence issue or more than that?
It's certainly a capacity and a competence issue. It's a serious paucity of resources, mostly financial, but also human. And I'm concerned that there may be more than that, yes.
Glynis, you highlight political interference in the NPA under previous heads like Pacoli and Abrams. So your proposed model, how would you ensure greater insulation from political pressure compared to, say, the Scorpions or the current ID?
Well, the model that I'm proposing is an independent, there are several private members' bills that are in the pipeline. One of them is to change the way the National Director of Public Prosecution is appointed. So a public participatory process, very transparent, giving everybody an opportunity to nominate, public interviews, and still the appointment by the president, that's his prerogative. But the national director must then be impeached. They can't just be fired like Vusi Pikoli was. So that will give the national director security of tenure and enable them to fearlessly do their job without the fear that the same sword that fell on Pikoli is going to fall on them. And then you spoke in your introduction about a revival of a defunct Scorpions. That's not what I'm proposing. I'm proposing something very similar to the Scorpions, but the big difference is we learned our lesson with the Scorpions. It was housed within the National Prosecuting Authority, as is the Investigating Directorate. It's not sufficiently independent, and it certainly doesn't have security of tenure, because it can be closed down by a simple majority in Parliament, like the Scorpions were. So what I'm proposing is a body that is set up outside of the National Prosecuting Authority that answers only to Parliament, derives its budget from the Treasury, not from the Department of Justice, therefore allows people to do their jobs without fear, favour or prejudice, and with no fear of being closed down because they go after politicians.
And critical to your model would be checks and balances that you would build into this process, I imagine, to avoid any kind of overreach.
Absolutely. The prevention of overreach is there for everyone to see. We have the rule of law. We have due process. You can approach the courts at any time. And an independent model would be very answerable both to the public and to the courts. So, you know, we certainly have sufficient checks and balances.
Glynis Breytenbach, crucial to your argument is staffing. The Scorpions, as we know, had fewer than the planned strength, and they were still disbanded. The big challenge here would be attracting, training and retaining high-caliber investigators and prosecutors, surely?
Sure, you need highly qualified investigators, very experienced prosecutors. You also need serious forensic capabilities, both investigative and for accounting forensics and cyber forensics. All cost money. But for a truly independent model, you could be innovative with regards to funding. You'd go to Treasury for your budget, not to the Department of Justice, so there'd be no political starvation of funds. And there are other innovative ways of raising the required money.
Would reforming the NPA's investigating directorate not be more efficient than starting from scratch?
Can't be reformed. It's housed within the National Prosecuting Authority. That is the problem. So it doesn't matter what you do with it, it doesn't matter how well you staff it, it doesn't matter how you try and insulate it. The fact of the matter is, as soon as they go after politicians, they run the risk of being closed down with a simple majority in Parliament.
So how
a body outside of the National Prosecuting Authority would be a Chapter 9 institution, and it would require a super majority in Parliament to close it down, and that's the kind of number that no political party is ever going to see again in this country. So they would be insulated from that kind of political malice.
And how difficult do you think it would be for a so-called Scorpions 2.0 to handle politically sensitive cases involving current senior officials, given the current landscape that exists at the moment? That problem would persist, surely?
No. Prosecuting is A, not for sissies, and B, you prosecute without fear, favour or prejudice. It doesn't matter who the subject matter of your investigation is. It's completely irrelevant. The problem now is that people have a muscle memory of the Scorpions being closed down when they did it, and they all know that will be my fate if I do it. So that's putting a dampener on the enthusiasm. If they have security of tenure and they know they're not going to be closed down simply for doing their jobs, then they'll do it. Prosecutors don't prosecute for money or for the fun of it. They prosecute because they want to serve the people. So that is what will happen.
And just a final one, any elite unit, as you've referred to already, requires strong financial backing. Would it be difficult, do you think, to persuade Treasury and Parliament in the current circumstances to consistently allocate sufficient and ring-fenced resources, as you've suggested?
It will be difficult, but it's certainly doable.
And where's the current thinking on this right now? You floated the idea. What kind of reception have you had?
Quite a chilly one, but that's what I expected. MK immediately came out and said that they would never support it, but of course not, because that would entail most of their party becoming immediate subject matter of investigations. The EFF is also not a fan for the same reasons, not surprising. So we'll have to see.
Glynis Breytenbach, thank you very much indeed.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, South Africa's pharmaceutical regulator, SAHPRA, says it's committing to slashing medicine approval times for local manufacturers, all part of a bigger push to grow vaccine and drug production across the continent. I want to talk now to Dr. Stavros Nicolaou, who's chair of PharmISA, that's the association representing South African pharma manufacturers. He's welcomed the move as a key step towards improving medicine access and reducing reliance on foreign imports. But my question: is this policy shift really enough to re-industrialize a sector which is under a degree of pressure, or maybe just more of a gesture than a game changer? So let's dig deeper. Stavros, a very warm welcome. So you're happy with the policy, but practically, what is going to change in the way in which approvals are going to be handled?
Jeremy, I think a starting point is to recognize two things. Firstly, that it's an imperative of our government and also the African continent to secure pharmaceutical supplies so we never get into a COVID type of situation again through localization policies. Regrettably, these have not been implemented as we thought they should be done or as they ought to be done. So I think we've got to give that recognition up front. It's a negative recognition. The second thing is that does this policy of SAPRA go far enough? It's certainly a start. There are a range of measures that South African government needs to take in order to further industrialize the pharmaceutical sector and narrow the trade deficit, as I put it earlier. Included in that suite of interventions should be accelerating the public procurement regulations. So there's probably no more important lever in boosting pharmaceutical industrialization than government implementing its own public procurement policies, which it's not doing at the moment. So the SAPRA move is an encouraging one. It's likely to attract some investment, some further investment into the sector, but also retain our existing investments. It would also, in my view, probably attract more technology transfer partners into South Africa, which is an important step. But it's one of many interventions that are required in order to narrow that trade deficit that I spoke about earlier.
Stavros, SAPRA says it wants to halve approval timelines, all well and good, but given its resource constraints, is this a realistic commitment or is something else going to have to give?
Look, I think SAPRA is an organization that is undercapacitated and I think under the circumstances does a fairly good job. We have had assurances from the CEO, the board of SAPRA, that they will dedicate the required capacity that's necessary and the resource in order to priority review all the products that were going to be locally manufactured. The important step there is that if you reduce the timelines significantly, as priority reviews do, then it does provide some advantage to local manufacturers, and that's good for the South African economy, which means more taxes are paid, and then you can further stretch budgets, health budgets, which we all know are currently extremely constrained.
You talk about tech transfer and also investment, but I'm wondering whether faster reviews alone can attract the kind of investment that you're referencing when more broadly industrial incentives remain weak and policy implementation, as we know in South Africa, is patchy to say the least.
Jeremy, I think it's one step in a basket of things that need to happen, right? And so if I've got to prioritize the three things that we need to do with immediacy to further industrialize pharmaceuticals, because, I mean, we have got an element of industrialization, and I think we've done under circumstances very well as a country. Certainly if I look at our local producers, Aspen, Adcock Ingram and others, I think have done well under constrained circumstances. But the three things that need to happen is, one, accelerated registrations and accelerated WHO pre-qualification. So you could say this policy addresses that. The second is the implementation of the Public Procurement Act, which, you know, government has not as yet implemented. And the third is we need a competitive suite of incentives so that we can compete against peer countries. That's the basket that's needed to be carried out. So this is one step in the right direction, but much more required to do. But we'll take the initial step and certainly try and maximize it as an industry.
What would those incentives, in your opinion, entail?
I think the most, this is all about leveling a playing field, Jeremy, which is rather uneven at the moment. So if I look at incentives that Asians and even other African countries offer to their manufacturers, the most prominent being tax incentives. SEZ incentives are very prominent in the pharmaceutical sector in both of those continents, and I could speak about other continents as well. But I think what needs to happen here is we've got to address the tax incentives first and foremost. For purposes of balancing what is a a rather, you know, untilted playing field at the moment that we've got to compete against as South African manufacturers.
It's also up to government, surely, to come to the party, and there's a concern about a lack of preferential procurement implementation. And the reality is that government has failed to act decisively in spite of promises.
Well, we've had the Preferential Procurement Framework Act for over two decades now, and I think most listeners will know that the regulations to the Framework Act were set aside about 2 years ago now, and government felt that they had to overhaul the Act, which they did in the form of the Public Procurement Act. That was assented to by the President last May, and there were clear signals that the regulations that will give expression to the Act would become available within 6 months. That hasn't happened as yet. We're now 14 months on, and you know, timing is everything with these things, because tender cycles come and go by, and if you don't have the procurement regulations in place, you're going to keep missing out. So I think a big call here would be to accelerate the public procurement regulations. They are exceedingly important, particularly in my sector, where a significant part of pharmaceutical volume is procured in the public sector. And that's where you can make a difference. I don't have to remind anyone listening in that manufacturing is about economies of scale, and economies of scale give you competitiveness, not only domestically, but also for export markets. So a big nexus between competitiveness and those public procurement regulations, which we anxiously await.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Dr. Stavros Nikolaou, Chair of PharmISA. That's the association representing South Africa's pharma manufacturers. Stavros, thank you very much.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Now, this might sound like an old trope, but I think it is fair to say that we are approaching something of a critical energy crossroads. Grid capacity is maxed out, and yet rooftop solar installations still remain stuck in a slow lane. Now, energy analyst Nick Headley argues that opening a dedicated national bid window for rooftop solar would be a game changer. Why? Well, it could cut costs, create jobs, ease grid pressure, and maybe help us hit climate targets. But launching such a program would also involve navigating policy, investment, and even vested interests. So Nick is a columnist, writer, and researcher. He's focused on climate change and energy transition. He's the creator of the Progress Playbook. It's a publication focused on policies and initiatives that are driving positive change. Nick, a very warm welcome to you. So you argue that we need a rooftop solar bid window, but how urgent is it really? Are we really at the edge of a crisis, at the abyss, or can the grid limp on for a little bit longer, do you think?
Hi, Jeremy. I think you nailed it with your intro. So we are very quickly running out of available grid capacity, and that is a problem because a very large chunk, pretty much half of our old coal-fired power plants are reaching their end of life in the next couple of years. It looks like we might do some extensions to them, but they are old and haven't been well looked after, so they are kind of limping along and will have to be decommissioned at some stage. So that means we need to bring a huge amount of new generating capacity online to replace that and also to satisfy growing demand for electricity. The problem with the traditional way of doing things is to connect new generators, we need to build a lot of new transmission lines. And that takes a very long time, and it's not cheap either. So where our best and cheapest available energy is in the three Cape provinces, and those have pretty much now completely maxed out available grid capacity, which means no new power projects can be built there. And it's going to take a decade to really build out the grid to where we need it to be. So we do need interim solutions, which also double as long-term solutions as part of a kind of balanced energy mix.
So is the problem a will to act and a will to act quickly, or is it simply the high cost that you refer to?
It has, there's so many issues at play here. One is just Eskom's very, it's technically kind of bankrupt, so it can't build new transmission lines. It's also been extremely slow and extremely slow to get the process going of, you know, working with funders who do have money available and the private sector to get things going. So I would say a bit of both. It's a lack of will. Eskom also really is trying to protect its monopoly. So it's a lack of will and maybe just a lack of sort of out the box thinking of interim solutions that are very desperately needed.
So if it's a combination then of maybe policy, finance or politics, which of those do you think would be the most easily addressed?
Finance, for sure. There is a lot of money waiting. There's a lot of capacity in the financial market, in the energy developer market waiting to kind of be unlocked. So that is the easiest, quickest win here. Just allow those with the kind of means to get the ball rolling to get on it.
Nick, let me ask you this. If I understand this correctly, and you'll tell me if I haven't, utility scale solar has received bids before, but rooftop is obviously different. Why is the rooftop model transformative compared to maybe larger solar farms?
So the idea here is to actually copy what some other countries have been doing. So Germany and France, for example, do state-run bids for both the big utility scale stuff and for rooftop solar. The advantage of rooftop solar is that you don't need to use the transmission grid. You don't need to develop long new power lines that take a decade. You can generate electricity right next to where it's used. So from the rooftops of warehouses and shopping centers and office blocks. So that kind of circumvents the whole issue of the lack of available grid capacity and buys us a lot more time. Rooftop solar is also a lot quicker to deploy because developers obviously don't need to go out and acquire land and secure environmental approvals and all of that. So it's very quick to deploy, and as I said earlier, there is a lot of kind of capacity just waiting to be tapped here.
Is there any danger that rooftop solar could cannibalize existing renewable projects?
That's a good question. So yes, we are a very long way away from that, from having a kind of duck curve and really excess energy at any time. We're a long way from it, but it is an issue that will come down the line, and we see that in Europe and China and other markets that are a lot further along in the process, where a lot of energy is now wasted because there's just too much produced during the middle of the day and a lot is wasted. But the way that that is being dealt with is now that batteries have become very quickly affordable, batteries are being deployed in those markets to kind of soak up all of that excess and inject it back into the grid when it's needed.
I'm assuming that any bid window would need some degree of standardization, but it would be critical to ensure fairness and quality and maybe avoid a flood of low standard installers, which we have already seen in some instances.
True. So I think we've seen when load shedding was at its worst in 2023 and 2024, it was a huge boom in rooftop solar installation companies, and a lot of them were kind of fly by night, not the best quality. I think now that the boom is over because load shedding has ended, a lot of the kind of weaker ones have been weeded out. But there are some really strong, very well developed companies there that would be very well placed to put together good bids. And obviously, this would be something that the IPP office would have to deal with, is ensure quality bids and a quality bidding process to get the right kinds of bids.
And who drives this entire process, Nick? Are we talking about an entirely new agency here?
No, I think this could be done by the IPP office and the Department of Electricity. So carving out just a bit of the REI PPP program for rooftop solar, and then allowing the IPP office to go about actually procuring that. So just like a normal REIP bid window, but just a dedicated bid window specifically for rooftops, which is the kind of model that France and Germany have been pursuing.
And just a final one, I'm assuming that you've applied your mind to what success might look like after any launch, say within a year or 3 years.
Yeah, I'll be honest, I'm just kind of punting the idea, but I do think, again, just to use the example of France and Germany, what they've been doing is a rooftop solar procurement window every kind of 4 months or so, just to keep a really steady pace and support the industry with a lot of kind of certainty. And that could gradually start driving down the price of rooftop solar, which is already affordable and more affordable than other kinds of new generating capacity. But it could drive down the price further and bring on a huge amount of new capacity and kind of relieve that urgency to build costly new transmission infrastructure, which won't go away, but will buy us time and maybe decrease the amount of new transmission and infrastructure that we actually do need.
Nick Headley, always appreciate talking to you about your ideas. Thank you so much indeed, columnist, writer, researcher, and also the creator of the Progress Playbook.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, it's World Public Relations Day, and the message this year is all about building bridges and navigating polarization. But in a country where trust in institutions is low, misinformation spreads faster than facts, and communication often treated as spin or window dressing, my question is South Africa's PR or communications industry actually fit for purpose? Bradley Howland is president of the industry body, the Public Relations Institute of Southern Africa, and says professionalizing the sector is no longer optional, in his words, an economic necessity. So let's test all of that with Bradley, and let's see whether the industry can and is delivering. So Bradley, a very warm welcome to you. Why an economic necessity?
Thanks, Jeremy. I think the one thing that I've often seen is that when it comes to business, is the function of PR and communications is often lumped into the marketing function, which means it becomes very tactical. And what I think is often underestimated is the fact that with a lot of the economic challenges that we face, many companies often feel a very tangible impact of poor communications or poor PR. And you see this in terms of either companies lose their social license to operate from reputational damage. You know, if they mishandle a crisis, they can easily lose a customer base. Government departments, as we know, happened with budget speech, where if they communicate incorrectly or poorly about something, it has real measurable impact, lost investment, reduced consumer confidence, and in some instances, even social unrest. And so from that perspective, it's often where poor communications or an underrepresentation of proper communications in a business has a direct tangible impact on both the organization itself and the economy. So it's why we as PRISA are pushing for a stronger framework and base for professionalizing the industry, to say that, you know, the idea of PR spin or anybody can do this, or the other sort of famous phrase is all news is good news, it often kind of misrepresents what good PR and communications looks like. It's not a nice to have. It's a fundamental risk management and long-term growth strategy for any organization.
All right. So central to your argument is that the industry needs to professionalize. But in many ways, that's also an indictment of your own industry, that after so many years, it's still in many respects not taken seriously or even trusted.
I think, look, it's yes and no, right? I think everybody is aware of the sort of famous case of the Bob Hottinger. And what that illustrates is that you can have one bad actor that tarnishes the entire industry. And like many other professions where you have proper professionalization, you think about the medical fraternity, you look at accounting, you look at the legal fraternity as well. Professionalization doesn't necessarily always mean that things are going wrong. It's about setting, you know, standard frameworks. It's about making sure that there are shared expectations when it comes to quality and ethics. And I think an important thing that often people misunderstand is that it's not just about regulation. It's about making sure that those entering the profession are properly trained and accountable, and that businesses can be assured that they're getting trusted, good advice as well. This isn't about titles, in my opinion. I think this is more about making sure that from the graduate who's entering the profession right through to that seasoned professional in a boardroom with a CEO dealing with a crisis, that you know that there is very clear accountability lines, that there is very clear frameworks when it comes to how to provide proper strategic communications for businesses to navigate those complex situations. And it's about making sure that when it comes to our quality and the ethics, from a business perspective, businesses know what they're getting, that there is a standardization to a degree of the level of communications and the quality that people will receive from communicators.
No one's going to argue with any call to professionalize any industry, but in Preece's respect, the industry body, I'd suggest to you that you have limited reach, you've got few enforcement teeth and no regulatory authority, so difficult to enforce those standards.
I think not really. What we are seeing with Preece at the moment is that Preece as an organization is growing, and our network is often misrepresented, or there's this perception that Preece just simply represents agencies and public relations professionals in a very linear form. And the majority of our membership base is far reaching. We've got government professionals, academic institutions, lobbying groups, right through to independent communication strategists and professionals as well, alongside the agency groups. And so that representation means that when it comes to the various committees and working groups that we have, they're very centered on making sure that the concept of professionalization touches every part of our industry, so that it's not just something that is about what we can do as an organization, but it's what as an industry we can do and how we're mobilizing everybody. From my engagements with many members and stakeholders in our sector, and I guess a lot of CEOs and business professionals as well, there is a need for this. There's a need for everybody to be aligned, whether it's just us or if it's also looking at our sister associations or other industry bodies as well. There does seem to be a unified call for this kind of approach to professionalize the way that we do things, to make sure that our standards are better. And I don't think that's something that we could ever argue against, is saying that actually we could be better. I think any industry would want to strive for that as well. And so for us, that's a really important thing that seems to be a unified call across the sector at the moment.
And your argument is entirely predicated on trust. And many South Africans still believe that PR professionals are either paid spin doctors for politicians or for corporations. How do you overcome that perception?
Well, I think that's exactly why we need to professionalize it. You know, when PR is done badly, it becomes spin, and I guess that's where we lose trust. And I think that's also something why the level of education, training, and I guess professionalization and standards is so important, because you can have anybody come into the profession and say, well, I can do PR, I can write a press release, I can create a story, I can do an event. And the reality is that unless you're properly trained, it can turn into spin so easily. Conversely, when it's done well, it's actually about telling the truth clearly. It's about building those relationships, and it's about managing complex issues honestly, which is ultimately what key stakeholders for any business are looking for. And so I guess by setting standards and improving training, ultimately what we're trying to do is to make good practice the norm, not the exception.
Bradley Howland, thank you very much indeed, President of the Public Relations Institute of Southern Africa. And that's where we're going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.